The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our online daily news site, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on what elephants understand. Elephants have some pretty complex behaviors, and we've talked about a few of them on the podcast, from elephants feeling compassion for one another to how elephant social order is impacted by trauma. But what about their social relationships with people? In a new study out this week, we learned that human language has an important role in our relationships with elephants. What languages are we talking about, Dave?
We're talking about a couple of African languages, one spoken by Maasai pastoralists. The Maasai men, particularly, don't have a great relationship with elephants. They kill them from time to time, either because the elephants are encroaching on their land or just to protest park policies in the Kenya's Amboseli National Park where they live. The other group is a group known as the Kamba, and Kamba men actually have a much better relationship with elephants. They're basically farmers that live in this area as well, but they don't threaten the animals.
And so the researchers went into this thinking that the elephants could somehow recognize language?
Well, they already knew that elephants made some complex distinctions between these two groups. If, for example, the Maasai men wear these very distinctive red robes, and the elephants, when they see that, they get very defensive. What the researchers were wondering was, could the elephants actually make distinctions between these two groups based solely on language alone?
And so how did they narrow it down to just those variables?
Well, what they did was they recorded men from both groups, and they recorded women and boys from both groups as well. And the people said things like, look over there, a group of elephants are coming. And if you listen to the sound file, this is actually a Maasai man speaking that phrase.
Ngura idiweji, neidia embo or kanjawoni ogra aponu.
And what they found was that the elephants really picked up on who was speaking and responded appropriately. So when they heard Maasai men speaking and the researchers played these recordings over loudspeakers to the elephants, they became very defensive. They retreated, they bunched together, they raised their trunks skyward, all very defensive behaviors when they heard the Maasai men speak. But they didn't have these behaviors when they heard Maasai women or children speak, or when they heard the Kamba people speak.
So even men speaking that other language didn't have the same effect.
Exactly.
And so I thought it was great they compared this to a lion. How does it relate to what happens when they hear a lion noise?
Right, and because when the elephants hear lions, they actually get very aggressive. They actually can charge the lions and try to drive them off. But they must have learned over the years that it's very hard to drive humans off and that humans are going to try to kill them anyways. And therefore, they are much more defensive.
To me, this demonstrates the extremely high intelligence of these animals. But is there anything else we can take away from the study?
Well, the hope is if elephants can understand us to some degree, maybe we can actually speak to them in a sense and try to keep them away from these situations where they would encounter people that would be trying to kill them.
Next up, we have a story on microbial warfare against us. Dave, I'm sure that you've had bad food adventures like me. This apple looks okay, small bite, no. Or pouring milk on your cereal and realizing something smells a little bit off and into the trash it goes. The question is, does spoiled food taste bad for a reason? Are tiny microbial poisoners saying, stay away, this is mine? Let's start at the beginning. When did people start even asking this question?
Well, this actually comes from a 1977 paper from a researcher named Daniel Janzen, who was inspired to write the paper because he was really upset. He had paid 95 cents and gotten a rotten avocado. And he began to theorize that maybe the avocado was rotten, not simply just because it had spoiled, but because the microbes that inhabited it were trying to keep him from eating it. So this theory was really intriguing, but over the past few decades, scientists have had a hard time proving it. And in fact, they recently, in 2006, found some evidence against it. They said, well, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense for microbes to be trying to fight us because that would take a lot of energy for them to be secreting poisons into this fruit or other food just to keep it away from humans. If they're spending all this energy doing that and other microbes aren't, they're going to be quickly outcompeted by these microbes.
So what's new? What's changed about how researchers are able to look into this problem?
Well, the researchers in this new study looked at it a different way. The previous work in 2006 had sort of assumed all microbes kind of land on fruit at the same time, and they're all competing against each other. But the researchers in this new study wondered, well, you know, say these poisoning microbes get there first. If they get there first, they actually can gain an advantage by poisoning the food, because not only are they keeping potentially humans away, but they keep other microbes away as well, so they can get rid of their competitors really quickly instead of having to compete against them.
Okay, I'm going to flip it around here. We're going to make it a which came first, the egg or the chicken problem. How do we know that people and other animals didn't just evolve to dislike this flavor or not want to eat it? Because, you know, eating rotten food could kill you.
Right. It's always very difficult to prove causation, especially in a study like this. We've got a very interesting correlation going on, but the jury is still out about whether microbes even care about us. As one expert says in the study, to a microbe busily rotting a banana, do we even exist?
Finally, we have a story on the genetics of human pigmentation. The textbook explanation for why some humans have light skin and some have dark has to do with the lifting of a constraint. When some of our ancient ancestors left Africa, they moved north and no longer had this intense UV rays of the equatorial living situation to contend with. But these people did face a new challenge in the chilly north, right, Dave?
That's right. So as people moved out of Africa and moved into places like Europe especially, very dark skin wasn't as advantageous as it had been in Africa. There wasn't as much UV radiation to contend with. These people were farther away from the equator. And as a result, they could, over evolutionary time, get lighter skin, which would have a benefit in this case, which is allowing them to produce vitamin D, which is also very important for us.
So moving north, you know, they didn't need to protect themselves as much, but they did need to start producing more vitamin D?
Exactly, and lighter skin allowed that to happen.
This is all a very long time ago. Homo sapiens arose in Africa about 200,000 years ago and migrated into Europe about 40,000 years ago. When did these changes in appearances first come into effect?
Well, scientists had long thought these changes happened pretty soon after people moved out of Africa. So this would have happened tens of thousands of years ago. But this new study suggests a lot of these changes may have happened a lot more recently than that.
So in this new study, they tried to take a closer look at when exactly these changes were happening and what the pressures were.
That's right. And they looked at 60 modern-day Ukrainians, and they compared them to skeletons, 63 skeletons, in fact, that had been previously found at archaeological sites in modern-day Ukraine. And these skeletons dated anywhere from between about 6,500 years old and 4,000 years old. And what they did was they looked at the DNA of both of these groups, and they were looking for genes that are responsible for pigmentation, also genes that are responsible for things like hair color and eye color.
Well, what were the differences and similarities between these two groups in terms of those genes?
Well, what they found is even at this late stage of people being in Europe, there seemed to be very strong what's called genetic selection for lighter skin and also lighter hair and lighter eyes as well. And this is kind of surprising because you would have expected this strong selection for these traits to have happened a lot earlier in people in Europe, but still seems to be happening relatively recently in human history.
So modern Ukrainians also had more variety in the genes that determine the color of the skin, the hair, and the eyes.
That's right.
There's just more choices for them. How do we know that this was selection and not just, oh, there's no more constraint, we can mutate these and it won't hurt us that much?
Well, that's the question, is why was this happening so recently? And the hypothesis the scientists have is that when we first came into Europe, we were still hunter-gatherers, which meant we were still getting a lot of vitamin D from the foods that we were eating. But as we became farmers, which only happened, you know, a few thousand years ago, then we started giving up these foods that may have been rich in vitamin D, turning more to grains and crops that were lower in vitamin D, at which point we really had to have lighter skin to get the vitamin D that we needed.
So it was diet changing as well as location.
That's right.
Well, what does it say about the change in hair and eyes that was also happening at the same time?
Well, that's a more interesting question. And one idea that researchers have is this idea that when these traits arose, and they probably arose fairly randomly, light hair, blue eyes, for example, that they were so unusual that the people that had them were strongly sexually desired. And the reason these traits proliferated is because these people were, for all intents and purposes, having a lot more sex than people that had maybe darker features, and therefore these genes spread fairly rapidly throughout the population.
Well, so is there anything in the genetic evidence that's suggesting that that's what's happening?
Well, we do know in other animals like guppies that individuals that develop unique traits become more sexually successful. So it's a big leap from guppies to humans, but it's possible the same thing happened.
What else is on the site, Dave?
Well, Sarah, this week we've got a story about what your hello says about you. Also a story about Neanderthal diets and how they may have been much different than we thought. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a shift in tactics among animal rights extremists, how they're more often targeting individuals rather than universities. Also a story about a legislative proposal by U.S. Republicans to reshape a major chunk of the U.S. government science funding enterprise. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out our latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.